I'm Bill Delaney. Robin Young is off today. It's Here and Now. Where the lights went out for millions in parts of the Northeast, Midwest, and Canada, it's now midday of the day after. And middling at best is the return of power to the still powerless. In many places, you still can't just flip those switches we take for granted that turn on bedside lamps and refrigerators and office computers and air conditioners, not to mention traffic lights, commuter trains, and nuclear power plants. In Michigan, the governor declared a state of emergency. Connecticut's governor asked residents to conserve power after a transmission line that had been working this morning became overloaded and fizzled all over again. In Cleveland, the water is back on after the blackout shut down the city's four pumping stations. And in New York City, Mayor Michael Bloomberg said subways may not be working again for the evening rush hour. But he compared the turmoil after the city's 1977 big blackout to the relative calm now, the mayor saying New Yorkers showed that the city that burned in the 1970s is now a very different place. Now, at this point, we're still largely in the dark as to what exactly happened and why in this big blackout. But we have a series of on-scene reports now, starting with New York, the city that never sleeps, by the way, they say, though last night thousands did sleep in buses, in parks, and on sidewalks. We're joined now by Dan Janison, who's been covering the story for New York Newsday. And welcome, Dan. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I was sleeping here at City Hall, so if I'm a little incoherent, that'll be why.
Did you find a nice sofa somewhere, Dan?
Yep. Yep, exactly.
Well, Dan, you're in City Hall's press room. Lights on?
Yep. They held the lights and the air conditioning and everything else all night. They got backup generators for this particular building. Our colleagues at the police headquarters and other places weren't so lucky.
Yeah. What's your sense of the streets of New York right now, Dan?
Kind of a sober morning after. The city's creeping slowly back to normal. There are problems left behind. There were releases by the sewage system because the electric pumps weren't working. So the beaches are starting to get sewage on them. The beaches of the city are closed. The East River has been polluted, and so they're doing tests on the water there now. Parts of all the boroughs are still without. Only Staten Island has been brought back entirely, I believe. So people are struggling there. One 40-year-old man died, possibly of a heart attack, at the scene of a fire in his high-rise apartment in Midtown, apparently set by candles used for light. Officials said firefighters found the place cluttered with debris, and they responded around 5:37 a.m. So as you can see, there are a lot of these lingering problems. Bloomberg said that the trains won't be on for the evening rush hour. His explanation was that they need to be repositioned after power returns, and many of the lights have to be tested. Also, summer school and school tests are canceled. Essential city personnel have been asked to come, but not those who are considered non-essential.
Dan Janison, thanks very much for joining us from a calmer but somewhat sober New York City.
It's a pleasure. Hang in there.
Thank you. Dan Janison of New York Newsday. Well, the latest investigations into the power blackout indicate that maybe Ohio, maybe Michigan, but probably not Canada, may have been responsible for the event. But earlier today, New York's Mayor Michael Bloomberg suggested our neighbor to the north was to blame.
It appears an event took place up in Canada and that the load shedding that perhaps they should have done was not done in a ways that prevented the New York power grid from having to try to supply power.
Well, joining us on the line to discuss the power blackout in Canada is Derek Stoffel, who's covering the story for CBC Radio in Toronto. And welcome, Derek.
Thank you.
Well, Derek, as you just heard, before we turn to the state of the streets in where you are in Canada, Mayor Bloomberg's pointing an accusatory finger at your country. What do you and what will Canadians make of that?
Well, lots of fingers have been pointed at Canada in the last, 20 hours since this happened. We heard yesterday right away from Mayor Bloomberg and then also from Governor Pataki of New York that something happened in Canada. But we up in Canada have been pointing fingers, too. It started last night with the Prime Minister's office, who said, well, there was a problem at a power plant in Niagara Falls, New York, either a lightning strike or a fire at the plant. And then our defense minister, something totally different from him, saying there was a problem at a nuclear plant in Pennsylvania. The latest in the blame game came from Ontario's Premier, Ernie Eves, who says, well, now it's something that went wrong at a power plant in the Midwest somewhere. So while it's blame Canada from the United States, we're certainly blaming the United States up here in Canada.
The blame game. Well, Derek, give me a sense of the streets of that great sprawling city, Toronto, that you're in.
Well, it would normally be fairly busy when I look out my window at my desk, but I only see one or two cars and a fairly, you know, I'm on a main street here in Toronto. People have heeded the call. We're in a state of emergency here in Toronto, and people are staying home or at least staying away from work downtown. So we have a situation where in Toronto and other major cities such as our nation's capital, Ottawa, we're at about 50% power right now. That's the last number. And what the goal is to get that up to about two-thirds by supper time. The problem is while power is coming back on in places in Toronto and Ottawa and Windsor, which is near Detroit, it keeps going off again. The grid just isn't stable enough. So we've got all kinds of people who may be cheering for a couple of minutes and maybe turning on their fans. It's very hot here today, 90 degrees. But then we've also been hearing reports of the power going off again. We're expecting that all weekend, that there's going to be intermittent power interruptions. Because of that, the subway system isn't going to be running until Monday at the earliest. We have streetcars that run by power here in Toronto, and some of them are running, some of them are not. So in the financial and industrial capital of Canada, it is not business as normal today.
A summery 90-degree day, though. Just to finish up, there must be some relief among Canadians that it's not the depths of winter.
Well, yes, I don't know if, you know, if we're talking in the sub-zero temperatures, it would we wouldn't want to have a power outage of this length at that time. But I don't know if people who are sitting at home and sweltering with no fans and air conditioners probably wouldn't mind a little bit of December right now.
Yeah. Well, Derek Stoffel, thanks so much for joining us on Here and Now.
You're welcome.
Derek Stoffel reports for CBC Radio in Toronto. That's where he joined us from. Well, we turn now to Detroit News editorial page editor Nolan Finley. He joins me on the line from Detroit, Michigan. And Nolan, I understand the governor has declared a state of emergency there. Do you know which counties are covered by that declaration at this point?
Well, most of southeast Michigan, most of Metro Detroit. We are intermittently out of power. I mean, some communities have power, most don't. Very little gasoline available, with long, long lines at the pumps. And it's been quite a night here.
Quite a night. A calm night?
Yeah, it's fairly calm. There wasn't much in the way of lawlessness, but just a real unusual circumstance for us. We've had partial power outages, but this was top to bottom across the area. We had to go to extraordinary measures just to get a newspaper out today. We went outside the blackout area, rented a hotel, moved a bank of computers, and then contracted with one of our sister papers out in western Michigan, the Battle Creek paper, to do an 8-page newspaper that we've got on the streets now.
Nolan, it must be a bit dispiriting. The governor is apparently saying that the power may not get back to places in Detroit till Sunday.
Well, Monday, actually.
Monday.
And, you know, I don't know that there's anybody horribly confident that, you know, that's going to happen. But
What about your water situation? We've heard about that. New York City, of course, gets its water by gravity. It flows from reservoirs upstate. They're not as reliant on electricity power stations and so on as you are. What's the water situation at this point? It was off for a while.
It's off still in many places. Some communities have it, some don't. And I think it depends where you're at on the water line. We didn't have it in our offices all last night. We have it now. I didn't have it at home, still don't. And what they're saying is don't drink it when it does come back. So, you know, unless you have gas stove and can boil it. So
there was an explosion at the Marathon Oil Refinery, it's been reported, and hundreds evacuated in that. Can you tell us anything about that?
Uh, you know, that's basically about all I know. I don't know that it's has anything to do with this. It's not uncommon for those sorts of things to happen. But, you know, we've had a number of fires overnight, and sirens went all night long.
You know, in cities are
really
In cities
hot
around
here too, by the way.
Like in so many places in the East, Nolan. Often, when there have been breakdowns in many cities around the country, there has been a degree of crime and looting. Has that happened in Detroit this time? And if not, why?
Very isolated. I haven't seen much of it. There were some reports that some gas stations had been looted, but it was very, very limited. And I think the police, emergency service workers responded very well, very quickly. I think they did a good job here. There's been a good police presence both in Detroit and in the suburbs. And I don't know that that we've had an extraordinary amount of lawlessness, which, you know, credit our residents, I guess.
Given that we've just discussed you may not get your power back, and just very briefly, Nolan, is there going to be anger about this, or are people just going to kind of get back to business when the lights come back on, just
well,
very briefly?
People are angry already. I mean, it's not easy to sit here in 90-degree heat, no power, no lights, no fans, and folks are what the question you hear most often here is, how on earth can a breakdown in Canada or Niagara or wherever it was knock us out of power this long, and why don't we have backup backup sources? And I haven't heard a good answer to that from anybody. So,
well, questions that journalists like yourself, among others, will be trying to answer in
the days to come.
Nolan Findlay, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Nolan Findlay is the editorial page editor for the Detroit News.
My name is Patrick Gerald. I'm a bartender at the Emerald Inn on Columbus Avenue. After the power went out, there's lots of people who had no place to go, and they, you know where they came. They came to the bars and looking for comfort and make friends and what have you got. And we were able to serve the people and the customers and all. Stayed open all night, actually.
A lilting voice from New York who offered some comfort during the big blackout. Coming up, the economic impact of a night without power, and California comes up with a novel approach to running a debate with more than 100 candidates. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Bill Delaney. It's here and now. On Wall Street today, power is back and trading is open, but all is still not back to
normal. This very, very, very clearly is a subdued volume, and that we don't see the kind of volatility that we ordinarily have been seeing in trading more recently. So I think it's really a matter of there is disruption primarily because people just simply can't get to work. But I think as the day goes on, that will smooth out.
That's Hugh Johnson, chief economist for First Albany Securities. As the power gradually comes on, what will be the long-term impact of all this? One of the largest power outage in U.S. history. Well, to help answer that, we're joined now by Patrick Anderson, principal economist with the Anderson Group in Lansing, Michigan. And welcome, Patrick.
Welcome to you.
Patrick, your group has been looking at the effect of the blackout on a state-by-state basis. Can you sum up what you're seeing?
We did look at it, and we used the same methodology we've done in the past, which is quite a conservative one. We start off by looking at what kind of production people are losing. Where are we really stopped doing what we would normally do that would benefit people and earn money for them? And on a state-by-state basis, you add it up pretty rapidly. If you take an estimate of the amount of the earnings that are lost in states, particularly such as New York and in Michigan, where the entire Detroit area has been out and is going to be out a good part of the day, it's a fairly significant number.
What kind of numbers are you talking about?
Our first estimate of this, and again, we don't know yet how long people are going to be out of work, but the lost earnings to U.S. workers and investors is somewhere between $4 and $5 billion.
It's extraordinary how it adds up so quickly.
But this is about compared with, say, the port shutdown of last year. It's about three times the impact of the port shutdown last year. Because in this case, we're not just taking goods and, say, moving them back a month, or you can't get what you want, so you buy a different toy. But we're actually taking people and pulling them out of work. They can't do their work. They can't earn money. They can't produce something that can be sold. So it is a serious loss to the economy.
But it's a quick blow for many businesses, right? I mean, restaurants and food merchants were selling out yesterday, then closing down. Retail stores had to close down. But then they'll open up again on that level of the economy, a short-term hit, right?
So the earnings that I talked about earlier, the $4 to $5 billion, are a loss to the entire economy because we don't produce those goods. In the retail sector, we also estimate that there's some spoiled goods. In other words, particularly food that's simply lost, meaning that it's spoiled, it gets thrown out, cannot be sold, and that adds to the total cost. It's hard to figure out exactly what that amount would be, but when we look at the amount of food industry inventories that are typical around this time of year, I wouldn't be surprised if we were talking about, say, $500 million in spoiled inventory that was simply discarded.
North America's automotive manufacturing shut down by this blackout. What will that mean for automakers?
Well, there's excess capacity in the auto industry right now. We follow the auto industry very closely and, for example, looked at the GM strike in 1998 as a very large economic detriment. So some of that lost production simply in terms of producing units isn't really lost in the sense that it's lost forever. But some of it is. Hot vehicles that are not produced mean that those sales go to automakers in Japan and Germany because somebody's going to show up. They're not going to say, "Hey, I want a set of wheels." They'll go buy something else. So we are going to lose something there, and also a lot of the design work. For example, the General Motors Tech Center in Macomb County, the Auburn Hills headquarters of Daimler Chrysler, and Farmington Hills. Also, there's a lot of engineering and design and other work that simply can't get done when the power's not on. And that puts U.S. automakers back a few days.
Now, Patrick, what about the long term? When something like this happens, does it make corporations, companies, people who do business wary of it happening again, as such that they may have to invest on levels they didn't before to protect themselves on some level? What is the long term impact?
Well, there's no doubt that people are going to have more battery backups and generators and other things. I mean, this shows what we didn't think would happen could, namely that a portion of one state's power grid could go so out of whack that it shuts down the next state. That had not happened before. It was always power outages were always confined to a certain area. So I think you can expect major expenditures in the power industry to prevent this kind of cascading effects, blackouts continuing. And I think you'll see more, I think particularly in the service industry. I think the industry is aware of this a little bit more, but service industry and retail industries, more investment in generators, backup power supplies, et cetera. And that's going to be a significant cost. At this point, we really have no idea how much that's going to be, but it is going to hurt.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Patrick Anderson, thanks very much for joining us on this.
Good to talk to you, and I hope your lights stay on.
Well, we've been lucky. We're broadcasting from Boston. We've had our lights. Patrick Anderson is principal economist with the Anderson Group in Lansing, Michigan.
This is Ingrid Smith. I'm from Brooklyn. I work in Manhattan at 45th Street. And about 4:15, the lights went out. So we went down to the lobby to see if it was just our building, but it wasn't. So we pretty much hung out in the lobby because there was nowhere to go. All the trains were shut down. A couple of the stores were open. The pizzeria had a gas oven, so there was a long line to get pizza, and some people were giving stuff away since the refrigeration was no longer working. We did have a radio in the lobby, so we did hear some news. Some of the phones working, but all the cell phones were out. So we camped out on the lobby, on the floor, or whatever chairs we could find. And my next door neighbor came, our next door store. He came back from Brooklyn. He had a car, so he said, "You'll wait a while and drive us back." All the traffic was still congested. So we left Manhattan 2 o'clock in the morning, and the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel was pretty empty at that time, but it was still dark. So it's been a very long night, and we're still waiting things to get going again back here in the electricity.
More voices from New York reacting to the blackout of 2003. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney. It's Here and Now. Coming up, the race for governor in California. We ask someone who knew him when. Is Arnold Schwarzenegger intelligent enough to be governor of California?
Let me go one step further. He is brilliant. And he's bigger than George Bush this week, at least.
And more on the power outage that's wreaking havoc in places like Cleveland, Ohio.
We're under a boil alert probably for the next 24 hours. The National Guard was called in last night, and they brought trucks with 450 gallons of water per truck.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Gina Cervetti. The largest power blackout in American history is prompting new calls for overhauling the nation's electrical system. As to the cause and origin, investigators say they are focusing on a massive electrical grid that encircles Lake Erie, moving power from New York to the Detroit area, into Canada, and back to New York State. Officials say there have been problems with the transmission loop in the past. Power is back on for upstate New York and 90% of Long Island. In New York City, portions, that is, of all five boroughs have power restored. But officials say subway service will not be back online by the afternoon rush hour, and there is no timetable for full restoration of power. Meanwhile, Mayor Michael Bloomberg says there were few instances of looting. He praised residents' responses to the blackout.
New Yorkers showed that the city that burned in the 1970s when facing similar circumstances is now a very different place.
New York Governor George Pataki says nuclear power plants that were shut down when the blackout began won't be able to be powered up for 24 hours. Meanwhile, in Cleveland, the outage affected all four city water pumps, leaving a million residents with dry faucets. The National Guard has tanked in thousands of gallons, and Cleveland Mayor Jane Campbell says once service is restored, tap water will need to be boiled.
Our water system services about 1.5 million people, and close to 1 million people were without water at some point during the night and may still be without water.
And the mayor says crime was up slightly overnight, with about twice the number of break-ins in a typical summer night. Meanwhile, passengers are still finding canceled flights and long delays at several major airports following yesterday's blackout. The French government is being criticized for its handling of the heat wave that's being blamed for as many as 3,000 deaths. French health officials say the actual number of deaths could be between 1,500 and 3,000. Pam Sampson has more.
The government's handling of this heat wave has sparked a lot of controversy here. Days ago, doctors were publicizing warnings that people were dying and that not enough was being done. And so there have been a lot of criticism from the medical community that the government didn't really respond. And now they're...
On Wall Street, stocks are lower. The Dow is down 16 points and the Nasdaq behind one. You're listening to Here and Now.
Delaney, Robin Young is away. It's Here and Now. 135 candidates are running for governor of California in the October 7th recall election. But according to the polls, one man dominates the race and the media coverage of it. Who else but Arnold Schwarzenegger? Dominating the field is something the bodybuilder turned action superhero is used to. That's abundantly clear already in the 1977 documentary Pumping Iron, which follows Arnold as he wins his sixth Mr. Olympia title. It's a remarkable document of a very ambitious man.
I was always dreaming about very powerful people, dictators and things like that. I was just always impressed by people who could be remembered for hundreds of years, or, you know, even like Jesus, you know, being for thousands of years remembered, you know.
Well, joining us on the line is George Butler, who produced and directed the film. He joins us from his home in New Hampshire, and welcome, George.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Well, George, when you were hanging out with him, were you meeting a person then who in any way you thought might become, well, first of all, a big-time movie star, let alone a political figure of the magnitude he suddenly is?
Well, it was pretty clear from the beginning that Arnold was the most ambitious person I'd ever met. He just didn't know how to proceed. And the book and the movie gave him a chance to go do it. What's most interesting about Arnold is that he had these plans way back in 1972 and 73, and he's fulfilled all of them.
He comes across publicly as kind of a nice guy. Is he a nice guy?
Nice is not the word I would use with Arnold Schwarzenegger necessarily, but the word I would use is canny. Another word would be intelligent. He is a very, very interesting person.
So he is intelligent.
Let me go one step further. He is brilliant. For instance, he so dominated his sport that you cannot think of bodybuilding without thinking of Arnold Schwarzenegger. When we did the movie, there were perhaps 25,000 people lifting weights in America. Today, there are 50 million people lifting weights in America. 100,000 gyms have opened up since Pumping Iron opened at the Plaza Theater in New York in January 1977. He married a Kennedy, which was one of his interests. He went to the top of Hollywood, and now he's just turned his attention to politics, and he's bigger than George Bush this week, at least.
Yeah, but George, can he pull apart a state budget? Is he smart in that way?
The guy is virtually a billionaire, and he's made most of his money outside of the movie business. He owns real estate all over America, and I just would be the last person on earth to try and underestimate Arnold Schwarzenegger. He just does what he says he's going to do.
Were George Butler not living in New Hampshire but across the country in California, would you vote for him?
I would follow the election very carefully. I project it's going to be completely unpredictable, and I would keep open my options until the last minute, which is what I always do in making my own films. And maybe I would vote for Arnold, and maybe I wouldn't.
George Butler, thanks very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure, Bill.
George Butler produced and directed the 1977 documentary about Arnold Schwarzenegger and a few others, Pumping Iron. Now, you won't be able to see Pumping Iron or other Arnold movies on California television in the near future. That's because networks would then have to grant equal time to all the other major candidates. The Sci-Fi Channel has canceled its planned Schwarzenegger marathon and quite creatively replaced it with a day of California disaster movies. Now, as for maybe teasing out a bit of substance from all this, California broadcasters are planning a debate for next month. Only candidates with significant poll numbers will be allowed in the door. Late-night television host Jay Leno will throw open his studio doors to invite the other candidates on his show September 22nd. Well, joining us on the line now to try to make sense of all this is Tim Rutten. He writes the Regarding Media column for the Los Angeles Times. And welcome, Tim.
Thanks for asking me.
First, a little news. Actor Rob Lowe and former Secretary of State George Shultz have now joined the Arnold Schwarzenegger campaign. You've written, "No political journalist need apply to cover this race." What do you mean?
Well, I mean, there are several unique aspects to the Schwarzenegger campaign, apart from the candidate himself. And one of them is that they're keeping the political and what you might call the serious press at arm's length. And the candidate speaks only to the entertainment press or makes himself available to magazines willing to take photographs but not ask questions. I believe up to this point, the only print interview that Schwarzenegger has given was with an Austrian newspaper.
Huh.
And they're not exactly aggressive questioners.
So Arnold will not take hard questions, at least at this point. Sure. You know, there's even an Arnold tie-in to the power shortage news today. Mr. Schwarzenegger is not responding to stories he met with Enron leaders during the California power shortage 2 years ago. Do you think he'll actually get to the October vote without having to answer a question like that?
I think it's quite possible, given the fact that this is a 60-day, now less than 60-day campaign. There are several anomalous things about this and about his candidacy. One is that if Arnold Schwarzenegger had to run in a primary in which all the voters were California Republicans. He'd have a snowball's chance in hell of being elected as the party nominee.
How come?
California Republicans are further to the right than Republicans in any state in America, including Mississippi. And they're further to the left than Democrats in any state, including Massachusetts. These are highly partisan, highly polarized exercises, these primaries. And the truth is that if Arnold's pecs were as ill-defined as his positions on the issues, we wouldn't be having this discussion.
Yeah, but voters like his character. Maybe they're not so worried about his competence. It's kind of a mess out there in California, and that's been made by politicians who know the issues and can read a budget.
Right. That's true enough. And that's what he's counting on. That's,
yeah.
That's the essence of this campaign. And, in fact, Sean Walsh, his press spokesman, has made that point, as has his campaign manager. They say repeatedly, this is a character election. This is not an issue election. And and they think the best way to project their candidate's character is to keep him away from the press.
Just to wrap up, Tim, in the little time we have left,
sure.
As a Californian, I mean, I'm going to ask you personally, does all this worry you?
Does it worry me? Yeah. Yeah, I'm a native of this place. And I think we have dysfunctional politics in the state. I think we suffer from an excess of faux democracy.
Well, you can't deny it's all interesting, whatever other trauma it may be causing some Californians.
If you link strange and interesting, yes.
Tim Rutten, thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure.
Tim Rutten is a columnist and senior writer for the Los Angeles Times. Well, it took only 9 seconds for a vast grid of generators and power lines to go dead last night. It'll take a good deal longer to figure out exactly what went wrong. But the calls for an investigation have begun, coming from the power industry, from Congress, and even from the president.
One of the things we'll have to do, of course, is take an assessment of why the cascade was so significant, why it was able to ripple so significantly throughout our system up east.
Today, there are already teams of electrical engineers, sleeves rolled up, hunched over computer printouts, beginning their postmortem of the blackout of 2003. Well, to find out more about who is investigating the blackout and exactly how they go about it, we turn now to Steve Connors of MIT's Laboratory for Energy and the Environment and former director of the Electrical Utility Program there. And welcome, Steve.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, Steve. Who's investigating the blackout, and how are they going about it?
Well, essentially, it's going to be the same guys that operate the system. There's no equivalent of the NTSB, National Transportation Safety Protection Agency, for the power grid. It's essentially mostly privately held, newly competitive, and tries not to overstaff and have too much administration there.
So the government doesn't send anybody?
Well, they'll be in the room and they'll be listening in. They do have power engineers, but their power engineers basically talk about issues and new technologies and aren't charged with running a big piece of the grid themselves.
So power companies who messed up will be investigating themselves? Does that concern you?
Maybe
messed up?
No, it doesn't at all. They're the ones that know the system best.
Okay.
What you do have here is actually competing power grids. So here, the folks directly affected were the Ohio grid, the New York grid, and the Ontario grid, with a little bit of spillover into PJM, which is Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Maryland, and here in New England.
Tell me about the computer system, Steve. One of the causes of Black Monday, the stock market crash of 87, was said to be computer systems. They operated too well, too fast, and helped spin a small problem out of control. Is that one thing they'll be looking at?
To a limited extent. The stock market automated trading is to essentially implement the preferences of the traders. And it's this one is automatic. It has to be automatic given the fact that we're talking about 60 cycles per second, managing that. It kowtows to the laws of physics. And so the automatic response is both necessary but fairly well-bounded.
Steve, in 10 seconds, how long an investigation?
I think they'll the actual technical postmortem, as you said, should only take a couple days. I mean, this is a well-understood system. It's telemetered fairly well. They're a little busy the last couple days getting the power back on, but the grid operators are a very conservative bunch from a physics viewpoint.
Steve Connors of MIT's Laboratory for Energy and the Environment, thanks very much. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Bill Delaney. It's Here and Now. Well, yesterday's power failure exposed some serious flaws in the electrical system, obviously. Here to help us understand how the power system works and its safeguards is Steve Klemmer, senior energy analyst at the Union of Concerned Scientists. And Steve, can you give us a basic explainer about what caused this giant blackout?
I'll give it a shot. I don't know the specific problems. I think that's still being worked out of what caused this particular outage. But there are some underlying problems and issues in the way that our system is designed that contributed to the problem, and I can talk about those. Obviously, yesterday, it was very warm out, and the demand for electricity was very high. As people turn on their air conditioners and so forth, which drives up electricity use. Because of that, the system, both at the local level and the broader regional level, was fairly stressed, and it was running near its full capacity. During times like that, when there's a sudden unexpected problem, such as an outage at a large power plant or something that takes out a high-voltage transmission line or something like that, it upsets the balance in an already stressed system and can have a cascading effect on other plants within that and other infrastructure within that system.
So one link in a very complex chain could have broken and the whole system goes with it.
That's correct. To give you an example, there was a major outage in the West a few years ago that was, my understanding, was initiated by a tree falling on a large transmission line and knocking that out during a period of high demand, and it knocked off the whole West Coast from power for a period of time. So it can be caused by weather-related events. It's just that the way that our system is designed has several vulnerabilities built into it. When a large power plant, like a large nuclear or coal plant, goes offline unexpectedly and there's not a lot of additional reserves to back that up, then it can have this cascading effect.
Why wouldn't those vulnerabilities have been built out of the system by now?
Well, there have been attempts to do that. One way to do that is to try to maintain reserves on the system to take into account a contingency like this. But those reserves, you know, are usually on the order of 15% to 20%. And, you know, during times of really high use, that can actually go above the levels that the planners have planned for, can create some shortages. The other issue is that over time, we've made attempts to make better connections between our regional power grids, including being interconnected with Canada. So if a problem like this occurs in one specific area, the thought has been that we can import power from another region that may have excess reserves and not be operating at full capacity.
Yeah, but I ask again, if we know all that, why haven't the safeguards been built in so that in what is really a fairly ordinary summer, we don't have a catastrophic blackout like this? Where do you point the finger?
Well, I think I've pointed to several causes of the problem. I think things that have contributed to the problem recently have also been the electricity deregulation movement that had occurred across the country did result in the uncertainty from that resulted in less investment in new power plants and transmission lines. And many utilities around the country slashed their operation and maintenance budgets, particularly for, you know, things like upgrading the local distribution system, which has caused problems in cities like Boston and Chicago. The other thing that happened was they cut efficiency programs by quite a bit. In California, the utilities cut their efficiency programs in half, which created a need for about 1,800 megawatts of additional power plant capacity.
Efficiency programs? What do you mean?
Efficiency programs to help customers install more efficient air conditioners, lighting, that type of thing, to reduce the need for more electricity.
Is this about a lack of leadership, whether from the local, state, or federal level, or is it all just about companies that don't want to invest, don't want to spend money because they're looking at their bottom line?
I think there's it's a little bit of both. There's definitely needs to be more long-term planning that encourages more diversity in the electricity system, and in addition to efficiency, using electricity more efficiently, which is the best short-term response that can be done rapidly. The other things that can be done fairly quickly are investing more in renewable energy sources like wind and solar power, and distributed generation technologies like fuel cells, combined heat and power at industrial facilities where you produce heat and electricity from the same fuel source. There's things like that can be done fairly quickly to help solve this problem. If you have a wind turbine that gets knocked out from a lightning strike, let's say, it's not going to cause major disruption on the system like it would if the lightning hit a large coal or nuclear plant or a large transmission line.
Steve, just to finish up, how likely is this to happen again?
Oh, I think there's a really good chance that it could happen again. You know, the electricity use has continued to increase. The weather continues to get warmer and warmer, and which has driven up electricity use as well, mainly from air conditioning. And so this problem is not going away. There have been more new power plants added to the system over the last few years in places like California and New England to help address this problem. But most of those plants have been natural gas-fired power plants, which are cleaner from an emission standpoint, but they're also subject to volatility in natural gas prices that we've seen evident in the last few years.
Complex situation, no easy answers, it sounds like, but thanks for helping us tease some of it out, Steve Klemmer.
You're very
welcome. Thanks very much for being with us. Steve Klemmer, Senior Energy Analyst at the Union of Concerned Scientists. He joined us from Cambridge, Massachusetts.
My name is Jim Jang. I'm a cardiology fellow at Mount Sinai Medical Center, New York. I was actually in the hospital during the blackout. The concern during the night was essentially how long the generator was going to last in the hospital, because we have some old wings at the hospital and some critical patients in those units. So I was concerned as far as what was going to happen to them, because I was hearing rumors that the power was going out in these intensive care units in these old buildings. And so through most of the night, patients were being transferred to the units that did have power. Finally, around midnight, when things seemed like quiet down and there was enough physicians around, I decided that I should try to make it home just to make sure things were okay at home with my wife. But it was completely dark on the street. Walking home was very creepy in the middle of New York City. And even my apartment was completely out, and I had to take the stairwell up, which had these candles. By the time it was midnight, most of these candles were down to basically the wick. And as I was going up each flight of stairs, the lights were going out one by one. And I lived on the top floor, and the hallway down where I lived was also dark. And all I could essentially do was yell for my wife. And fortunately, she was up, and she opened the door, turned her flashlight, and I was able to make it home. So it was kind of crazy, but right now I'm enjoying the day with my wife close to the hospital and waiting to go back. I already went back this morning. Things seemed like they were stable and the patients were doing well, but I'll probably be back sometime this afternoon again.
Another voice from New York reacting to last night's and still today's massive power outage. Well, just to recap, President Bush has asked people who are still without power to be patient. He says it's going to take a while to get all the power on, and he said it's time to update the grid.
I view it as a wake-up call. You know, I've been concerned that our infrastructure, the delivery system, is old and antiquated. And I think this is an indication of the fact that we need to modernize the electricity grid.
Much of the state of New York is back online. In Detroit, though, it might be late Sunday before full power is restored. And House Energy and Commerce Committee Chairman Billy Towson of Louisiana said he is launching an investigation into the blackouts. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Bill Delaney. Get into your radio and join us again here and now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.